In November 1956, Elvis Presley made his motion picture debut in the musical western Love Me Tender. By December 1956, the title song from the movie was topping the musical charts. Elvis was officially a bona fide star. Millions of adoring fans rushed to see the picture during its first month in release. Sisters Barbara and Patricia Grimes were among those fans. Only these Chicago siblings had already seen their new favorite movie an astounding 10 times. And on December 28, 1956, the young sisters headed out to Chicago's Brighton Theater to watch the future king of rock and roll play Clint Reno once again. The sisters made it to the movie and watched it an 11th time, but they never made it home that night, and their family never heard from them again. But there were possible sightings of the two young girls, one as far away as Nashville. This led to the theory that the sisters had actually run away to meet Elvis. But something far more sinister happened on that cold December night. Join us for episode 55 as we discuss the unsolved murders of the Grimes sisters. Hello, and welcome back to the 3 a.m. Mystery Club. I'm Brandon.
I'm Ro.
I'm Derek.
Hey, everybody. So as you could tell from my intro, it's my turn tonight, and I'm going to be telling you the story of the Grimes sisters. I've been eyeballing this case for a long time because it's really right up my alley. It's set in the 1950s. There's a big pop culture element and, of course, a double murder. Are you guys ready to hear more about the unsolved murders of the Grimes sisters?
Absolutely.
Tell us.
The Grimes sisters were two of seven children born to Joseph and Loretta Grimes. Barbara Jean Grimes was born on May 5th, 1941. Patricia Kathleen was born a little less than 2 years after her sister on December 31st, 1943. The two girls grew up in the McKinley Park neighborhood of Chicago. McKinley Park in the 1950s was a working-class neighborhood where families were still rebuilding their lives and chasing new dreams after the Great Depression. Joseph and Loretta Grimes divorced shortly after their seventh child was born, which left the family struggling at times. But Loretta Grimes did what she had to do to take care of her children. McKinley Park was known as a safe and decent place for children to grow up in the 1950s. It wasn't a place known where young girls went missing or ended up murdered. Not until the final days of 1956. Friday, December 28th was a typical winter day in the Windy City. Christmas decorations were still hanging and empty boxes and wrapping paper were still sitting out in trash bins. Kids were pulling their new radio flyer wagons and trying to build snowmen from what little bit of dirty snow covered the ground. For Barbara and Patricia Grimes, that Friday was one they had been waiting for all week. Their favorite idol, Elvis Presley's new movie, Love Me Tender, had just arrived at their neighborhood theater after closing its run downtown, where they had dragged their mother and older siblings 10 times before. This time they could spare their mother and siblings and hop a bus just down Archer Avenue, not far from their home. That Friday was also special because it kicked off the weekend before Patricia's birthday, and a party was planned with some friends for that Saturday. Patricia was younger than Barbara, but she was known to be much more outgoing and was actually 3 inches taller than her older sister. Barbara was quieter and meek, but the two sisters were inseparable. And one of the things they bonded over the most was their shared love of Elvis Aaron Presley. The two had actually just joined his fan club and were waiting on their welcome packages to arrive in the mail. So for the Grimes sisters, it was all Elvis, all the time. Loretta Grimes wasn't thrilled about letting her 15-year-old and almost 13-year-old go off to the movies alone, but they had dragged her to see the movie several times before, and the Brighton Theater was so close. Barbara was the one who talked their mother into letting them go off on their own. Loretta went along with the idea and gave Barbara $2.50 to cover the movie, some popcorn, and the bus ride home. Yes, in 1956, you could do all those things with $2.50. The girls made it to the 7:30 p.m. movie, bought some concessions, and settled into their seats, according to some friends who saw them there. The Brighton Theater was holding a double feature that night, of the same movie, by the way, so that would be their 12th time seeing it if they were to stay. So they were expected to be home late if they decided to stick around for the second showing. Just before midnight, Loretta Grimes started to worry about her two daughters. Surely they'd be home by now, she thought. Shortly after midnight, Loretta sent her 17-year-old daughter Teresa and 14-year-old son Joey out to look for their sisters. The brother and sister went to the bus stop and waited. After three buses came and went with the sisters on none of them, they headed back home to inform the mother. Loretta then called the police. Police were notified of the missing sisters at around 12:30 a.m. All officers in the area were put on alert and a search for the two girls began. By the following morning, when the girls had still not shown up, Loretta Grimes was in a panic and thinking the worst. The situation was officially listed as a missing persons case. An official investigation began. By Monday, which was New Year's Eve and Patricia's birthday, the missing girls were front page news and a special task force was being assembled. The group of officers and community members canvassed the area for the girls and went door to door, talking to residents and handing out flyers. As the days went on and nothing turned up, the news of the missing girls went national and the sightings reports started to pour in. People from all over the country had reported seeing the girls in one state or another. A woman reported seeing the girls in an apartment store listening to Elvis records. Another saw the two girls at a bus stop several states away. But one of the most widely known sightings came from Nashville, which led to a theory that the girls had actually run away from home to try to meet Elvis. And when the theory really picked up some steam, Elvis himself got involved. The rock star took to the radio from Graceland to plead for the girls to return home. Quote, "If you're good Presley fans, you'll go home and ease your mother's worries," end quote. Loretta Grimes and much of Chicago did not believe the sisters had run away. Everyone had their own theories as the city became obsessed with the case. The entire community got involved and never gave up on the search. The community even began raising money to assist Loretta Grimes, which eventually would raise enough money to pay off her mortgage. For many, this obsession would become one that would distract them from their own fears. The Grimes sisters weren't the first children to go missing in Chicago in the 1950s, so parents were really starting to worry about their own children and community. A year earlier, three boys, two brothers and their friend, were kidnapped and murdered on Chicago's southwest side. But that's a case for another time. After an exhausting month of dead ends, the search for the Grimes sisters stalled. But on January 22, 1957, a man by the name of Leonard Prescott was driving home when he saw what he thought were two mannequins along a back road in Willow Springs, Illinois, just over 25 miles from downtown Chicago. Prescott wasn't sure what he was looking at exactly, but he had a feeling. So he continued his drive home and got his wife. Leonard drove back to the site, and much to his wife's protest, she joined him in taking a closer look. As the husband and wife inched closer to the discovery, they realized they were not mannequins, but the naked and frozen bodies of two girls. Police were called to the scene, and it didn't take long for them to suspect that the bodies were Barbara and Patricia Grimes. Police actually drove Joseph Grimes, their father, to the scene to identify the bodies. And that he did. They were indeed his daughters. Barbara was lying on her left side and Patricia was on her back, partially covering Barbara's body. The way the bodies were positioned, investigators assumed they were thrown from a car or truck, and then they were eventually covered by snowfall. Three wounds that police believed to be caused by an ice pick were found on Barbara's chest, and it appeared she had suffered blunt force trauma to the face and head. Numerous bruises were also discovered on Patricia's body and face. Autopsies were performed the following day by three experienced forensic pathologists who, after an exhausting five-hour examination, were unable to agree on an actual date or cause of death. The experts did discover by examining the sisters' stomach contents that both had most likely died within 5 hours of the time they were last seen alive at the theater. Their stomach contents contained potatoes and cookies which they had eaten at home and popcorn from the theater. So most likely the time of each death would have been either late the evening of December 28th or the early morning of December 29th. The cause of death in each case was ruled as being a combination of shock and exposure, although this conclusion was reached only because all the other causes of death had been ruled out. Also, it was concluded that many of the wounds discovered on the sisters' bodies had most likely been caused by wild animals, and the punctures resembling ice pick wounds were most likely inflicted after death. No obviously fatal wounds were discovered on either victim's body, and toxicology reports revealed that neither had been drunk or drugged. None of their clothing items were found either, but the bodies appeared to have been cleaned. The examinations also discovered that Barbara had likely engaged in sex, either consensually or not, around the time of her death. And while the cause of death sounded accidental and natural, the official death certificates of both girls would list their cause of death as murder. One of the examiners, Dr. Walter McCarran, surmised the sisters' bodies had lain along the roadside for many days before their discovery. He said he believed that the body's preserved condition had been due to the freezing temperatures in the weeks prior to the date of the discovery. McCarran also concluded the girls' bodies had laid undiscovered for more than 3 weeks because a layer of snow had blanketed the area on January 9th. Despite McCarran's report, the chief investigator for the Cook County Coroner's Office, Harry Gloss, disagreed with the time of death, later stating that there had been numerous marks of violence on those girls' faces, strongly indicative of them being the recipients of violence as opposed to post-mortem animal attacks. Gloss also insisted that a thin layer of ice found on the sisters' bodies indicated they had most likely been alive until at least January 7th, since only after that date would there have been enough snowfall to react with the girls' natural body heat to create the layer of ice on their nude bodies. Gloss concluded that meant their bodies had been warm when they had been dumped, since only after January 7th had there been sufficient snow to create such a layer of ice. So had the girls been held captive for weeks? But what about the stomach contents? And if they were dumped along the road the same night they were kidnapped, how did it take so long for anyone to discover their bodies? Had someone actually frozen the girls in maybe their basement or someplace else prior to dumping their bodies? But then there are all the sightings. I didn't even mention half of the reports of the Grimes sister sightings. People had said they saw the sisters as early as December 30th and as late as January 14th. And of course, as we know, there are often a lot of these incorrect sightings in the cases we cover. There are just so many questions with this case. The Grimes sisters' murders is still officially unsolved, but what about suspects? Police interviewed hundreds of people about the murders, and some very solid suspects came up. One of them was Edward Lee Benny Bedwell. Bedwell was a 21-year-old drifter from Tennessee who bore a striking resemblance to guess who? Elvis Presley. Bedwell worked part-time as a dishwasher in a Chicago Skid Row restaurant, and according to the owners of the restaurant, John and Minnie Duros, he and another young man had been at the diner along with two girls who resembled the Grimes sisters in the early morning hours of December 30th. The Duros reported this information to the police on January 24th, 2 days after the discovery of the bodies. Bedwell was arrested shortly after and interrogated for 3 days. Initially, he said that John and Minnie Duros were mistaken, that he eventually signed a 14-page confession to the murders and was charged with the crimes. In the confession, Bedwell said he and a 28-year-old friend of his named William Cole Willingham had indeed been with the Grimes sisters on December 30th and kept their company until January 7th, where they drank, ate hot dogs, and fooled around with the sisters. Bedwell said this was all consensual, but after several days, things went south. He said he and Willingham had beaten both girls before throwing their nude bodies into a snow-filled ditch when the sisters started refusing their sexual advances. Loretta Grimes read this confession and didn't believe any of it. When Willingham was picked up, he admitted that he had been with Bedwell and with two girls on December 30th, but claimed the girls had not been the Grimes sisters. He also denied any involvement in the murders. Bedwell himself would eventually recant the confession, saying that he had only confessed after being held in custody for 4 days and being coerced and beaten. Of course, this sounds very familiar. How many times do we hear this exact story in our cases? At least mine, all the time. Yes, so many false confessions, so many coerced confessions. It's just incredible. And this is 1955. It's been happening since and before and after. The autopsy reports backed up Bedwell's new claims, as no alcohol or hot dogs were found in either victim's blood or digestive systems, nor had the girls been beaten to death. Benny also had a work alibi on the night of their abduction. Bedwell was eventually freed and the charges against him were dropped. There were some other suspects, but no one was ever convicted. There was one very likely suspect, though. In May 1957, Loretta Grimes received a telephone call from an unknown man who claimed to have undressed and killed her two daughters. Although the Grimes family had received many prank calls following the girl's disappearance, this caller really struck a chord. He ridiculed police efforts and laughed at the blame being placed on Benny Bedwell. And then he ended the phone call with something that sent shivers down Loretta's spine. He said to the grieving mother, quote, "I know something about your little girl that no one else knows, not even the police. The smallest girl's toes were crossed at the feet," end quote. The caller then laughed before hanging up the phone. Loretta knew no one knew about her daughter's foot deformity, so she was convinced the man on the phone had actually murdered her girls. But who was he? In 2013, a retired police officer named Raymond Johnson began a personal investigation into the Grimes sisters' case. Johnson became interested in the case in 2010 when he had been researching a book he was writing about Chicago's history. Johnson became obsessed with the case and said it was one he thought was very solvable. He pored over records and interviews and came up with one name: Charles Leroy Melquist. Melquist had been a 23-year-old self-confessed child killer who had been on the suspect list of the Grimes sisters' case. Melquist had been convicted of the 1958 murder of a 15-year-old girl named Bonnie Lee Scott. Her decapitated body had been found 2 months after her disappearance, less than 10 miles from where the Grimes sisters' bodies had been found. Following the discovery of Scott's body, investigators had noted similarities in their murder and body disposal in that of the Grimes sisters. Nonetheless, Melquist was never even questioned for the Grimes sisters' case. And here's something that makes me really think this was the actual killer. The day after the body of Bonnie Lee Scott was found, Loretta Grimes received a phone call from a man who claimed responsibility for Scott's murder. He told Loretta, quote, "I've committed another perfect crime. This is another one those cops won't solve, and they're not going to be able to blame Bedwell." Loretta Grimes believed this to be the same man who had called her and discussed her daughter's toes. She knew this man was the man who killed her daughters. But was it Melquist who made the phone calls? We'll never know. Melquist was never charged with the Grimes sisters' deaths and died in 2010.
Okay, well, before we say anything, I just still can't get over they went to a movie and got snacks and took a bus ride for $2.50.
I know, isn't that something? When I first started researching the case, I started looking up gas prices and all this stuff, and I was going to go through all that at the beginning. And then when I realized how much money they were sent to the movies with, I was like, I'm going to cut that out because we're going to be talking about this later because of that very reason. So yeah, a double feature, popcorn for two people, probably a drink, a bus ride. Imagine that now. Today you would spend like $60 on just the popcorn and drinks.
Yeah, that makes no sense. So the man who called the girl's mom and said that the youngest daughter had the two crossed toes, what was his name?
He was an unknown caller. He was one of very many prank calls they got. I just can't believe that happened in the 50s. Like all these people calling, saying, "Hey, you know, I killed your daughter," or, and then laugh and hang up.
That's really crazy to me. And I wonder if he actually was a prank call or if he was the person responsible, because I feel like if it was a prank call, he would have to be someone, obviously, who actually knew that. And in order for somebody to be that cruel, that person would have to be pretty angry, I would think, at that family to make a horrible joke like that. I mean, that's not a funny joke.
Right. And in the 1950s, they did release a lot of information. If you remember back to the Betty Gail Brown case, when the Lexington police and newspapers released every single detail, a lot of things were released. And there were 150 people at the crime scene, like not police officers and community members, they volunteers, like people just swarmed the crime scene. They fouled it up, you know, how they always did in the 50s. So even if there was, substantial evidence, it was probably ruined. But the fact that Patricia had a toe deformity was never released anywhere. I don't even think police discussed it. I mean, I'm sure that, the autopsy noted it, but it was never part of the investigation, so it wasn't important. So somebody who knew that was either, very close to the case and decided to just be super cruel for no reason, or was the actual killer.
I think it was the actual person because it doesn't make sense. I mean, granted, I don't think somebody in the 50s would have been scared about having a phone call traced. Like, I don't think they would have probably thought about that too much back then.
Right.
I don't know, but doesn't seem like it.
No, you'd have to have the FBI involved for that then.
I feel like it was probably the person responsible. Do we know if they ended up staying for that second showing? I'm just curious.
That we do not know because the friends who saw them left before the second showing. So I'm thinking they may have, because if they were at a 7:30 movie and the movie is probably about 2 hours in, well, less than 2 hours in, an 8-9, because I would say police think they probably were abducted around 11:30. So I would say they probably did, unless there was some weird things going on and the girls left the movie and ended up, you know, doing things that 15 and 12 year old girls shouldn't be doing, especially in the 50s. But I think they did. So I think they probably saw the movie a 12th time.
This is horrible. It's very sad. And I don't know where I've heard this before, but I have. And I didn't know like all of the details, but I've heard of this before and I don't know where I've heard it.
Yeah, it's a case that I've been looking at for a long time. And I just kept going back to it. Like, it reminds me of the scene in Pee-wee's Big Adventure when he keeps running back to the pet store looking at the snakes and he doesn't want to grab them, but then he eventually does. And I'm being that detailed because I kept looking at this case and I'm thinking, oh gosh, I can't do another case about dead kids or dead teenage girls, you know. And I was, but then I just kept going back to it. And finally I was like, okay, when I looked a little closer and there were all these Elvis details and the fact that he actually, you know, made a radio plea, I was like, okay, yeah, this is too Brandon for me to not do. So I finally, you know, grabbed it and here we are.
Oh, it's very you. It's perfect. And now I'm imagining you like Pee-wee running into the room to your computer screaming, holding a picture of them on your phone or something.
Do I do it? Do I don't do it? Do I do it? Do I don't do it? It was going to be either this or Mr. Krull from Australia. And I went with this. So stay tuned for Mr. Krull at a later date.
Well, thank you for that, because I had never heard of this case before. So all the information you're throwing out there is new information to me. So that's why I've been kind of quiet. I'm trying to process it all.
Well, I need a theory then.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to think. So as far as the crank call goes, I agree with Derek. It's either the killer himself or possibly just a sicko from the morgue who takes pleasure in upsetting grieving families, but most likely it was probably the killer.
Well, and you know, no offense to people who do those jobs because they're very important jobs, but sometimes those people are a little creepy. So, that's a possibility.
Yeah, that's why I was like, well, you know, 9 times out of 10, everybody's great, but then you have that one person.
Exactly. But yeah, the first call was about the toes. The second call was about the new murder, Bonnie. And that person, you know, so that person decided to call her after that murder just to kind of like, hey, I've done it again. And so I think it has to be the killer. And by the way, I don't think I said this in the story, but Loretta Grimes did say that she was pretty certain the voice was the same. So the two callers were the same person, because she said she would never forget that voice because in her mind, she knows that is the man who killed her children.
That is crazy. And I wonder what it is about killers that make them want to harass the family members. Like, I know it's some sort of jolly for them, but what is it specifically, I wonder? Like that, I don't know if fascinate is a good word to use, but that fascinates me. Like, what is it that's making them want to do that?
Right. That's something I want to look into also, because we keep mentioning it and I want to know more about it so I can talk about it. So I'm glad you asked that question, because I'm definitely going to research that. But yeah, it's kind of like when, you know, a killer will return to the crime scene. They're calling like a year later when the crime scene is long gone, you know, and just to get more jollies, I guess. And it's disgusting, of course. But yeah, it is. Yeah, fascinating is not, you know, maybe fascinating is the right word, because I would like to understand it as well.
Me too. I mean, and that even goes back to one of our very first cases we started this podcast with, the lady that disappeared at the ER, and then the family kept getting phone calls.
Was that Dorothy Scott?
Yeah,
Dorothy Scott. I thought that too. I was thinking, this is just like Dorothy Scott. They called and harassed her family, and of course, who do we always talk about? The Golden State Killer. It's right up his alley also.
Yeah. So this is definitely something we might need to do a side episode just on particular psychological issues that we find interesting that come up in these cases, like hyperbrystophilia, Munchausen, going back to the scene of the crime, taunting the police, taunting the families. Like, that would be a good mini episode for us to all chime in on.
Yeah, because I've wanted to talk about hyperbrystophilia for a while now. And if you don't remember, we've mentioned it before. That's when somebody, usually women, are in love with male serial killers. That's not my explanation. That's the explanation. And so we're fascinated by that. Like the Menendez brothers, people are in love with those guys. Of course, you know, their guilt is still up in the air with a lot of people in their minds. They don't believe they're guilty at all. But that's often the case with, you know, the people who were in love with Ted Bundy didn't think he was guilty. And then there's an actual name for it.
Yeah, and it's crazy to me. It reminds me of, which I'm the same way, when people, like in a superhero movie, when people actually like the villain more than they like the hero.
Yeah.
Only these people seem to not be able to see how it's fictional, you know, reality versus fiction. They can't, it's almost like they can't separate that.
Yeah, and there's a part of me that is that way too. And it kind of, sometimes I'm like, oh shit, why do I love Joffrey on Game of Thrones? It probably goes back to the reason why I love true crime and horror movies and all that. It's not that I relate to the bad guy. It's just that I'm most fascinated by the bad guys.
Right. Well,
fictional stuff, I've always liked the villains too. And in that, they're just more entertaining.
Yeah, even Disney villains, villainesses, you know.
But not in real life.
Right. Yeah, because we can kind of differentiate. But yeah, it's the same way with me with Marvel, like the character Loki, not just because Tom Hiddleston plays him, but the character is fascinating to me. But in real life, I would see all those red flags and I'd be like, stay away.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And like Sherlock, like Moriarty, like I'm obsessed with that character. Like, and he's like one of the worst bad guys there is.
Right. But he is fascinating and he's fun to watch. He's fun to follow. So I wonder if that's how it is for these people, except something in their brain just doesn't know how to click it off to be like, hey, this is not real.
Yeah, yeah, for real. I mean, you know, there are lots of fans of serial killers too. So, I mean, like not just people in love with them, like they do idolize them, unfortunately, but that's just how it goes.
This was really good. Like I said, I had heard of it before, but I had completely forgotten and didn't know all of the details.
Good job, Brandon.
Thank you. And I want to remind you once again that we now have merch. We have t-shirts and mugs and socks, and we're going to have some more things, stickers and all that. But you can find our merchandise from the links on our social media. It's on our website. So thanks to everybody who has purchased, and thanks to those who have shown us their mugs and t-shirts. That's Benny and Eric and Kathy. I'm sure there's some others, but I can't remember right now. But so if you do get any of our merchandise, we'd love to see it. Tweet us a photo or send us a Facebook message, and we'll gladly shout you out here.